Hey there, Nick Mott here. I hope you enjoyed this season of The Wide Open. We have some additional, shorter stories coming to you soon, but this week we're doing something a little bit different. We're sharing with you an episode from another podcast called The Wild with Chris Morgan. It's produced by our friends at KUOW in Seattle. This season, ecologist Chris Morgan is traveling to national parks around the country to explore the biggest threats to biodiversity and what parks are doing to address them. On this episode, The Wild heads to the hottest place on Earth, Death Valley National Park, to learn about the Devil's Hole pupfish. This tiny creature, just an inch long, sparked one of the biggest water rights cases in U.S. history. And fun fact, back in my younger days doing conservation work out in the Desert West, I spent several weeks in Death Valley, killing invasive tamarisks and palm trees, and I even got to see this little pupfish with my own eyes. Their story is really a fascinating one. You can follow The Wild on your favorite listening app, so find that show wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's head to the desert.
I'm in the driest place in North America. It's so dry that I can hear static in my hair when I run my fingers through it. I've driven over 1,200 miles to get here, through countless different landscapes, all the way from Washington State, a place known for its rainfall. Washington gets almost 40 inches of rainfall a year. Where I'm standing here gets 2. And it's not just the lack of rainfall that makes this place unique. This enormous desert ecosystem is a land of extremes. From the towering sand dunes. I'm walking up the sand dunes here. It just looks like a slice of Saudi Arabia. To mountains covered in dry, crusty shale. With brown bulges and black rock cascading down the slopes like chocolate syrup.
It's like a giant scooped a whole bunch of ice cream. Yeah. It's like we're on an ice cream plant.
I've never seen anything like this. It's just like I'm in like a whole nother world, like a dream or something. It's super cool. I love how it's formed.
To over 200 square miles of salt. And then off in the distance, this giant salt pan and people walking all over it like they're ice skating around Central Park ice rink. And not only is it the driest place in North America, it's the hottest place on Earth. So this is the actual spot where the hottest place on the planet was recorded in 1913, and it was 134 degrees. I'm standing in Death Valley National Park in the Mojave Desert. It's where California bumps up against Nevada. The park is huge, about the size of Yellowstone and Grand Canyon National Parks combined. It sits where two of Earth's tectonic plates meet. Over hundreds of millions of years, they've created snow-capped peaks, ash-spewing volcanoes, and sagging low points that once held lakes. In the rain shadow of the Sierra Nevada, the heat that builds beneath Death Valley's cloudless skies has nowhere to go. It radiates off barren rocks and sinks into the valley bottoms, where it warms, baking everything it touches and evaporating any water foolish enough to linger at the surface. It's hard to imagine anything growing or surviving here in such a dry and hot place. But peeking out from an enormous sand dune, this tiny mushroom. I've never seen a mushroom growing in a sand dune before, but it's clearly found enough moisture to make life work. And that kind of sums it up around here. You have to work very hard to eke out any kind of living at all as a wild creature or a plant. But there's one essential ingredient that no life can happen without. Beneath miles of dry desert land, in the largest national park in the lower 48, is something you can't see from the crusty surface. Hidden underground is a secret watery world, and in it lives a fish. The world's rarest fish. It's less than an inch long iridescent blue and looks better suited to an aquarium tank in your living room than a desert. But by surviving here, this tiny fish has made history, and it has changed our understanding of desert water in some remarkable ways. From KUOW in Seattle and Chris Morgan Wildlife, welcome to the wild. Sunrise on the morning of the popfish count, and I'm following two pickup trucks full of scuba gear and a white Tesla whose license plate reads Cave Diver. It's just the most surreal thing I've ever experienced, going scuba diving in the desert. I'm on the road following a convoy of scientists to a place called Devil's Hole. It's a tiny spring on the edge of Death Valley National Park. Critical habitat for a little fish called the Devil's Hole popfish. They're called popfish because of how they seem to play with each other, like puppies. And this is their only home. Wow, there's a big, tall chain link fence around a small section at the base of this mountain. I think that might be it. Devil's Hole is carefully protected. The popfish are listed as critically endangered. So a lot of work goes into making sure they are kept safe from other species, especially humans. Going through a kind of a cage system here, like walking into some kind of wilderness prison. There's chain link fence over my head here and either side. Solar panels all around. Oh, this is cool, and a little walkway over a cave. This is the hole. Standing in the short caged walkway, I'm looking down into a small rocky chasm that's about 100 feet across. There are big boulders down there and a few aluminum stairs, and then a rope leading to a black hole at the bottom that's full of water. The shape of a perfect rectangle about the size of a large pickup truck. It's hallowed ground. It's the smallest habitat for any wild fish in the world. And it's the center of a lot of attention, especially today. And there it is, the famous Devil's Hole. So the biologists are down there getting some things ready. I'm meeting a team of biologists and diving experts from Death Valley National Park and Nevada Department of Wildlife for a very special event in the popfish calendar, an event that only happens twice a year. The fish are so special, so endangered, they try to count every single one of them to see how they're faring. This count happens once in the spring and once in the fall, and I'm lucky enough to be with the team that does it. Okay, heading down into the abyss, it feels like. Down a little metal staircase. The team is preparing their scuba gear in the early morning desert sunshine.
So today we're going to be going down to about 115 feet in depth.
Jeff Goldstein is a fish biologist with Death Valley National Park. He's one of the divers who will be counting the fish.
It's pretty amazing. Once you get past this restriction at 75 feet, it's pretty much you don't see any sunlight. You won't see the surface of the water.
The rectangular black hole is a tiny window into a vast cave system that's full of water. Nobody knows exactly what the whole cave looks like. It's too dangerous to explore. But to perform the count, the divers have to leave the comforting light of the desert sky and swim through a dark passage under a slab of rock to where the cave opens up.
So if something was to happen and you didn't feel comfortable, you're initial reaction when you open water divers, go to the surface. Well, you have a ceiling on top. You can't just go to the surface. You may have to go horizontal for 50 to 100, 200 feet, depending on how far you've penetrated into the cave.
The divers use artificial lights to see where they're going. Without those lights, they wouldn't even be able to see their hands in front of their face.
It's I take it you're not claustrophobic then.
This is the funny part. I am.
Really?
But for some reason, with my training and everything, I've gotten comfortable being in this type of environment, this type of conditions that we see at Devil's Hole.
Four divers will go into the hole together today. Two are responsible for counting the fish. The other two are the safety team, responsible for getting their partners out in an emergency. In the 1960s, before there was a fence, two high school friends drowned in the Devil's Hole during a disastrous nighttime adventure. Their bodies have never been found. The divers today are meticulous about safety as they run through their gear and checklists. This is not a place you can afford to mess around.
I'm going to pressurize the system and we'll test, make sure everything's working properly. That's good. That's good. Cool. We are good. On the gear here.
How many fish do you hope to count today?
Oh, I always hope for more, but you just never know. Uh-huh. Fingers crossed we hit over 200 fish.
Okay.
That would be phenomenal for me.
That's the magic number?
Hopefully.
Scientists from Death Valley National Park have been counting the Devil's Hole popfish using the same system for over 50 years. They care a lot about the survival of this fish. The numbers are small and always vary, so the fear is that they could be lost completely. One of the biggest threats is water level. At one end of the hole of water is a ledge, like a table-sized shelf that has just a few inches of water over it. This shallow space is where the Devil's Hole popfishes breed, the only place they breed. If the water drops below it, there's nowhere for them to reproduce and lay their eggs. The females breed year-round thanks to the constant temperatures in Devil's Hole, but they don't exactly breed prolifically. A Pacific salmon can produce thousands of eggs at a time. A Devil's Hole popfish produces one or two. It deposits the eggs on the shelf in the shallow water. Not all the fertilized eggs make it to adulthood. Fluctuating water levels and other threats like predatory beetles can take their toll. Even earthquakes can be a factor. Dr. Kevin Wilson is an aquatic ecologist for Death Valley National Park.
Certain earthquakes around the world can cause large 6-foot waves in Devil's Hole.
The pressure waves created by an earthquake can cause aquifers across the world to slosh around.
Right, and we'll have earthquakes, say, in China, like in 2008, that killed tens of thousands of people. Devil's Hole went woo, 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 woo. So it's connected to the whole planet, practically.
And even if they survive all this, the successful adults don't live for more than a year. So a collapse in the population would happen very quickly. It's why this team of biologists keeps such close tabs on how they're doing. Last spring, they counted 175. Some years they've had under 100, and it's been all the way down to 35. This one cave of water is the Devil's Hole popfish's only natural habitat. So for this remarkable little fish to survive in the wild, this, in other words, is it. As I watch the divers prep, I'm imagining how cold the water must be down there in that watery cave. I'm wearing a coat in the chilly desert spring. They don't feel like ideal swimming conditions.
All right, I'm going to turn this on so I might get a little loud.
It's 92 degrees, so it's...
It's what?
92 degrees in there, the water.
No.
Yeah. So it's really strange sweating underwater.
I was picturing it as cold. I can't even figure out the physics of that. What?
Yeah.
How is that even possible? How is it warm, the water?
Well, I don't know.
It's 93 degrees because it's very deep.
Kevin Wilson again.
Divers have been down to 436 feet, didn't see a bottom, but it's probably over 1,000, 1,500 feet deep.
Wow.
So it's warmed by being deep within the earth.
Warmed by the earth's
itself,
core
getting
magma
close,
heat.
Getting closer to the center of the earth.
Of course, the water in Devil's Hole doesn't go to the center of the earth, but it does go down far enough to absorb heat from the molten rocks below. The truth is, no one really knows how deep Devil's Hole is. No human has ever reached the bottom. And it's led to all kinds of mysteries and legends. Paiute Indians who have lived around here for over 9,000 years thought the hole was a portal to an underworld city. But they also warned a monster lived down there that could swallow you whole.
And that was to keep children from staying too long in Devil's Hole because it's so warm, 93 degrees. I mean, that's bath water.
Yeah.
So if you stayed in there too long, this baby monster would come get you.
Prospectors working their mining claims in Death Valley in the mid-1800s washed themselves off in the warm water, giving it the name Miner's Bathtub. Charles Manson, the cult leader, meditated here for 3 days shortly before his arrest, believing it would serve as his pathway to the underworld. A nearby range is called the Funeral Mountains.
So there's a very eclectic background or diverse type of ideas in philosophies or, you know, mysteries of Devil's Hole.
We follow the divers to the edge of the hole. Each of them has a person in front to help them through the boulders to the water. It's tricky footing, especially carrying scuba tanks. And just then, there's a flash of wings. An owl flies out, adding to the mysterious feel of the place. Things are quiet down here. You're cut off from the rest of the national park, cut off from civilization. I'm looking right into Devil's Hole. The water is crystal clear. There's emerald green algae growing on the rocks. And there they are. I can finally see some of the fish now. Tiny little things, no bigger than the last section of your pinky finger. They have beautiful blue and purplish colouring, milling around like tadpoles. One by one, the divers slide into the water.
It's all very slow and gradual. I was expecting the divers to kind of jump in, but of course that would scatter all the fish, so they're slowly backing down. Some aluminum steps that they've put across this frame that covers the hole, going in really slowly.
Looking good?
It's a gentle process. Feels very methodical. The only other sound in this echoey chamber is the sound of bees from a hive tucked under a rock wall.
Everyone, have a good, be safe. We'll have a fun, safe, productive day.
Thank you, sir.
For the next hour, they dive slowly through the layers of the cave, counting pupfish. They swim at a constant rate, trying not to miss any fish, and trying not to double count any either. One of the divers told me sometimes the curious little fish swim right up to his mask. They'll do 4 of these exact same counts over the next 2 days to get as accurate an estimate as possible. While the divers are underwater, 3 surface counters get to work, and it's their job to count the fish that are in the few inches of water that's over the shelf. They line up on aluminum grates that have been spread across the opening to the hole. They've got knee pads on because they're on all fours, peering into the water.
I've seen fish counts before.
14, 34, 34, 36.
But none of them quite like this one.
Two more.
There's a lot of tiny fish.
Yeah.
30.
How many?
30.
30.
It's like a game of fish bingo. Nobody knows for sure how long popfish have lived at Devil's Hole. Nobody even knows how they got here. But they have somehow figured out how to survive in some punishing conditions. The water is as hot as bathwater. It's very salty, more than most oceans, and it contains very little oxygen. Food can be sparse, and every bit of it matters. Even the owl that's been nesting down here plays a role. Occasionally their poop lands in the Devil's Hole water and provides a few nutrients that help algae grow and tiny invertebrates live. Algae and invertebrates that the popfish then eat. It's a precarious existence. And since all their spawning takes place on that shallow rock shelf at one end of the pool, the water level has to stay high enough to keep it covered. So if Death Valley is the hottest place on Earth and the driest place in North America, how is there any water here in the first place? The answer to that question is right under our feet.
When you're looking down at Devil's Hole, it's a window into the groundwater or the aquifer.
Kevin explains what's going on.
And what that is when you drill a well into the ground and you hit water and you can start pulling water out, that's the groundwater. So here, we don't need a well to see where that is. We're looking right at the water table.
When rain does fall here, or snow in the surrounding mountains, some of it trickles into the earth and becomes groundwater. It flows really slowly, downwards, filling gaps in the gravel, soaking into porous rocks and pooling in underground caverns. Where this groundwater collects is known as an aquifer, and the water in the aquifer here can sit there for a long time, sometimes tens of thousands of years. They even call it fossil water. These ancient storehouses of water are invisible to us until they leak to the surface, usually at springs and seeps. But at Devil's Hole, something unusual happened.
So what happened was the ceiling collapsed about 60,000 years ago, and big boulders got stuck from the ceiling between the two sidewalls.
When that ceiling collapsed, it became the open chasm we're in, and it exposed the normally hidden aquifer, the rectangle of water in Devil's Hole. And at that moment, light got in, which allowed life to grow, including the popfish. The Devil's Hole popfish have lived through a lot over thousands of years in this unique home. They've adapted and they've survived. But there was one event 50 years ago when this remarkable ancient fish was almost wiped out. The water in Devil's Hole was disappearing. After the break, how this little fish ended up protecting water not just for itself, but for countless other species too, by swimming all the way up to the Supreme Court.
I'm going to see if this rare plant is in bloom. It's been hit very hard by drought, and so that's why I'm kind of like going on a little wild goose chase here to see if we'll even see them, because some years they don't even come out.
Well, I like a good wild goose chase. Patrick Donnelly is a conservation biologist. He's the Great Basin Director from the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm out here to meet him this morning at a pretty special place called Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge. It's only just outside Death Valley National Park, but the landscape couldn't look more different. I'm surrounded by more green than I've seen since I arrived 5 days ago. And Patrick is clearly on a mission. Oh, he's got his head down in this little wet area, it looks like here. Looks like he's getting closer, looking for this one plant in this massive landscape. Ash Meadows is over 20,000 acres in size, but Patrick seems to know exactly where he's going. He's up ahead of me, meandering eagerly across the shrubby hills, GPSing one hand and walking stick in the other, scouring the ground. You found it? No way!
Here she is.
Oh my goodness.
Another one right there.
The little plant that Patrick has been looking for is called the Ash Meadows Milk Vetch. Down on all fours, he pushes a dry, thorny shrub aside to show me. A small cluster of flowers, 3 or 4 inches tall, growing out of the crusty soil.
Oh, look at that. See these beautiful pink flowers. They're so pretty.
Can I ask you, what is the significance of finding this plant? You're really excited about it. Why?
I love these plants, these endemic plants. They're like one of my favorite things about living here and working here is all the endemic biodiversity here. And I'm a plant guy, like more than a animal person.
Endemic biodiversity. This plant, the Ash Meadows Milk Vetch, is endemic to Ash Meadows, which means it grows nowhere else on Earth. If you look this threatened species up online, a map pops up with a little green dot where this plant lives. You can zoom out to the entire planet, but that's the only dot on the map, right here where I'm standing with Patrick. As we walk a bit further, Patrick's eager to show me why he's brought me to this spot. I hear it before I see it. Behind some head-high shrubs is a bright blue hole in the ground that's gushing water. A desert spring. Ah, water.
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of it.
Oh, a lot of it.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that. Yeah. I was like expecting a tiny trickle. It's crystal clear, and the color of turquoise from the minerals refracting the light. Long strands of arm-length algae are waving back and forth in a current from below. That's because water is flowing at full speed out of a small 8-inch hole in the very bottom of the spring.
And there is hundreds of gallons of water per minute pouring out of a hole in the ground there.
All that spring water is coming up to the surface from a river, an underground river called the Amargosa. That fossil water that has slowly seeped into the earth. The Amargosa River stretches about 185 miles from near Beatty in Nevada till it peters out in Death Valley National Park. Most of it lives below ground, but it's flowing through the gravel and limestone under our feet, as slow as 1 foot every 10 days. Every so often, the water pops up through the cracks in the bedrock to the surface in this dry desert landscape, where it creates a watery oasis for plants like the milk vetch Patrick was so excited to find. Scientists have taken samples of this water at locations over 100 miles apart in the Amargosa Basin, and they found the same chemistry in multiple places.
Right. And so you can actually say that's the same water because the geochemical signature is the same.
Like water DNA.
Like water DNA, exactly.
So all that water is connected underneath the desert. As we peer into the spring, I notice something. More pupfish. But these are not the devil's hole pupfish. their close relatives.
10,000 years ago, there would have been a lake here. During the Pleistocene, there was a tremendous amount more water here, and all these pupfish were one big pupfish population interconnected across the basin. It was only in the past 10,000 years, as this became a desert, that their habitat basically shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and then eventually they were cut off from their brethren and speciated at that point.
Became different species.
Right.
As everything here dried out, the fish that survived adjusted to the conditions of the particular spring that kept them alive. They became specialists. The devil's hole pupfish, for example, stopped growing pelvic fins and instead spent that energy finding ways to adapt to the low oxygen and high salinity found in their cave. Their ash meadows cousins that I'm looking at don't have a deep cave of water as a refuge in a drought. So they adapted to survive in a half inch of water for short periods. The unique environments that were created didn't just shape pupfish. They shaped other plants and animals, like endemic snails that are smaller than a grain of rice.
And they're really unique because, this is very mineralized water. You can see the minerals. That's why it's got that color. And the spring snails create their shells from the minerals in the water. And so they're very highly adapted to the very particular conditions in these springs, the temperature, the geochemical composition. If you just put them in a fish tank in your house, they'd probably die because they are finely attuned and evolved to live in these springs.
In this land of extremes, everything is perfectly adapted. There's a holly bush that turns its leaves sideways to the sun to reduce evaporation. There's a cacti that photosynthesizes at night when it's cooler. And there's a vole that spends almost its entire life under 6-foot mats of fallen bulrush, where summer temperatures are cooler by 30 degrees. And then there's the salt that's everywhere here. The spring water that wells up in the refuge picks up minerals from the rocks below. Everything here has to deal with salt.
For some reason, I licked my forearm yesterday. Don't ask me why, but I was salty, and it wasn't sweat.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost in the air
Whatever
here.
You touched. The plants that grow here, we call them halophytes, which means salt lovers. They are adapted to growing in highly saline soils, and they have special evolutionary mechanisms to deal with those salts.
What you end up seeing is evolution in action. Everything here has had to change to survive in very tough, very specific conditions.
And so life really thrives here, but it is separated from the nearest other water by long distances. And so these species over millennia eventually became their own species because they had no interaction with other fish from other locations or other spring snails from other locations. And so eventually their range constricts and they only live here. And so that's why this is, one of the most biodiverse places on Earth.
I was just in the Galapagos. It reminds me of that.
They call this the Galapagos of the Mojave Desert.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like it's that significant, right, in terms of animals and creatures that you don't find anywhere else.
Absolutely. I mean, we have this incredibly high level of endemism, and one of our hydrologists calls them islands in reverse because it's an island of water in an ocean of desert. And so, the same principles of island biogeography apply here as apply in a place like the Galapagos.
And like the Galapagos, these springs are like a living laboratory for how evolution works, including the presence of at least 26 species that are found only here at Ash Meadows, home to the greatest concentration of endemic life in the United States. But it's a home we came very close to destroying.
In many ways, Devil's Hole is used as an indicator of the health of the aquifer. When the water's rising in Devil's Hole, that means there's more water all over the aquifer. And if the water is declining, that implies that the aquifer as a whole is declining, and that means these springs and these wetlands, would be gradually drying up.
50 years ago, the water level at Devil's Hole had become dangerously low. The drop in groundwater was being caused by ranches nearby that were pumping it out of the ground. The shallow rock shelf where the pupfish spawn was becoming exposed, and without a place to breed, it would have been the end for them. But as an endangered species, the pupfish had federal protections.
So in 1976, the United States Supreme Court stepped in, ordering ranchers to limit their pumping so that the water at Devil's Hole stayed above the spawning shelf. A simple copper washer fixed to the cavern wall in 1962 provided a marker. Water couldn't fall more than 3 feet below that washer. This landmark water rights decision changed the way we thought about protecting a species by protecting its habitat. And the ruling didn't just save the pupfish. It switched how the country thought about groundwater. It was a game-changing case. It basically said the federal government has a right to protect groundwater resources that sustain parks and protected lands.
So it was like a pivotal case.
Pivotal all across the country. It affected every protected land in the country because now the agencies have the ability to go out and assert rights for that water.
Yeah, like a watershed moment.
Ah, that's good.
I wasn't even trying to be corny there, but really was, right? Just in terms of it being a moment in this watershed's history.
It was really the start of conservation in the Amargosa. So it really was foundational and kicked off what's now, you know, a half century of trying to protect these ecosystems.
Without these protections, the land I'm standing on with Patrick would have been a different place.
There was a proposal to build a city here, Calvada Lakes, and it was going to be a city of, you know, 50,000 people right here in Ash Meadows. And they actually started bulldozing, like, to create the city. And the Nature Conservancy stepped in and purchased the whole thing and eventually donated it to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And that was 40 years ago this month.
What would we be looking at right now if that hadn't happened?
You'd be in the middle of golf courses and subdivisions right now if it wasn't for that purchase and that creation of this wildlife refuge. Pretty remarkable.
And it all started with one tiny fish.
And so what the Devil's Hole pupfish did was illustrate that the groundwater and the biodiversity and the human life are all one in this basin. You know, protecting water for fish is protecting water for people.
And then the other way around as well, protecting water for humans is protecting water for all of these other species downstream.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost like our fates are interconnected.
But as times change, new threats evolve. The geology of those grinding tectonic plates under the desert means several valuable metals can be found here. Nearly 50 years after the Supreme Court saved the pupfish and the groundwater, now a new underground treasure threatens the water. Lithium. You've probably got some in your pocket right now. It's the stuff that most phone batteries are made of. There's a lithium mine proposed not far from Ash Meadows. Any large-scale pumping from underground water could impact both Ash Meadows and Devil's Hole. Part of Patrick's job is to protect groundwater, and that means doing everything he and his team can to stop the mining from happening.
I got a team going to DC tomorrow to try to get Congress to withdraw it from mining.
It's complex, and the irony is that these days lithium is the stuff that's used to make batteries for the electric vehicle industry. Part of the clean energy movement we all need to halt climate change. But mining lithium here threatens what makes this place unique.
There are many places to produce lithium, but not all of them are directly next to a wildlife refuge with 26 endemic species on it. And so, you know, I think our general orientation is, yes, we need lithium, but we have to produce it in the right places.
The connections between water, people, and biodiversity are as clear in Death Valley as they are in any place I've been. But I'm still struck by how much money and effort is going into preserving the small number of tiny pupfish back at Devil's Hole. It's a big ongoing operation. There's even an artificial replica of Devil's Hole. They built it indoors to breed a backup population of the fish in case it's needed. Would it make a difference if these small populations of species like the pupfish, the milk vetch, and the spring snails disappeared? I've got to ask you, why do the species in this habitat matter? I mean, we can't even see most of them.
The animals and the fish and the spring snails and the rare plants, you know, they're all part of the biodiversity that makes the world go round.
But so, isn't it difficult, though, when you can't see the species to point to say these are important so people get it?
You know, there are microscopic organisms all over our Earth that vastly influence our lives, you know, from microbes in our gut to spring snails filtering water. And so protecting the spring snails means protecting the water, and that means the water is available for humans as well. So the argument is, if this aquifer goes dry, we all suffer. Humans, spring snails, rare plants, we all suffer.
It's 2 weeks after the Devil's Hole popfish count now, and I'm back home in Washington State. The magic number for this year's spring popfish count is ready for public release. So I called up Kevin to find out how many fish he and his team officially counted. The moment of truth, I'm going to give Kevin a call and see how the popfish count went. Fingers crossed. Hello, Kevin. Kevin, hey, it's Chris Morgan calling. I'm going to jump right in. I'm dying to know, what are the results of the count? How many popfish?
I knew that's what you were calling about. It went well. The number, including the scuba divers and the surface count, was 191 popfish.
191. How do you feel about that number?
I'm ecstatic. It is the highest spring count in 25 years.
Oh.
A quarter century.
I just got goosebumps. That is incredible to hear.
It is. It is.
Did you crack a beer when you realized what the final number was?
Not on site. Maybe at home Sunday evening.
once the uniform came off.
Exactly.
It's so heartening to hear Kevin's excitement about the result. 191. Just 9 popfish short of what they were hoping for. He's watched the ups and downs of this little fish's journey for decades, and I can tell this result gives him hope, and rightly so. There are plenty of other examples of species like the Devil's Hole popfish whose future hangs by a thread, but whose very existence has a knock-on effect for the ecosystem. Threatened and endangered species all over the world, shaped by thousands of years of adapting and surviving in their very own unique homes. It's a reminder to not leave any species or their habitats behind. Even when it looks like it's just a playful little fish in a small watery hole in the ground in the middle of the desert. Patrick compares this complex web of life to something that really brings it into familiar focus.
Biodiversity is like a Jenga tower. You know, we have all these pieces interlocking that make it work. Every extinction, every species we lose is like pulling a block out of the Jenga tower. And we don't know when we've reached the point of collapse. Once it collapses, you know, we're a part of that Jenga tower too.
This season of the Wild is about the incredible biodiversity in our national parks, from the tallest trees on the planet to the driest deserts and everything in between. And it's about the people working in and around our national parks to protect the natural world while we still can. As always, there are some great photographs and clips from our journey through the national parks on Instagram at The Wild Pod and at Chris Morgan Wildlife. The Wild is a production of KUOW in Seattle and Chris Morgan Wildlife, with support from Wildlife Media. This show would not be possible without listener support. You can help us continue to create this special, immersive storytelling by donating to KUOW. Go to kuow.org/donate/thewild. Thank you. Our producer is Lucy Suchek. Writing for this episode by Christopher Preston. Jim Gates is our editor. It's hosted, produced, and written by me, Chris Morgan. A very special thank you for their kind financial support to Jill and Scott Walker, Rose Letwin, Ellen Ferguson, Anna Kimball, John Taylor, Paul Lister, Bob Yellowlees, Barbara Stallman, and Barton Brooks. Our production team includes David Brown, April Craig, Marshall Eisen, Michaela Giannotti-Boyle, Tatiana Latre, Matt Martin, Kara McDermott,
Amelia Peacock, Darcy Riggins-Schmidt, Brendan Sweeney, and Hans Twite. Our theme music is by Michael Parker. I'm Chris Morgan. Take care of yourselves and do what you can to take care of our beautiful planet. Thanks so much for listening.